fathers, he does not, you know, like make a distinction between the reward and punishment in the hereafter and in this world. So he was saying to his people, don't think that you would die and that's it. Your life is, that's your life. And whatever you have is in this world. Whatever good things you can attain is in this world. Whatever bad things happen to you is in this world. And there's no world after death. There's no afterlife. No, that's not the case. We have heaven and we have hell. When you die, it doesn't mean that that's the end of your life. You have another life in the other world. And on the day of judgment, that is when you would either go to heaven or hell based on your deeds. We'll continue the discussion about these two verses after a short break.
You are my one true love, taught me to never judge. Now all I want is to be with you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Like Muhammad. So the Prophet is Mubashiran wa Nadhira, Wada'iyan ila Allahi bi'idhnihi wa Sirajan Munira, and one who invites to Allah by His permission and an illuminating lamp. So the Prophet is a person who just doesn't say that Allah exists, there is one God, there is heaven and hell, I'm here to give you the good news of rewards in the hereafter if you're a good person and punishment in the hereafter if you're bad and you commit sins and you don't believe in Allah. No, I also invite you to Allah so that you actually believe in my faith, in Islam, that you become monotheists instead of idolaters and polytheists. Because, you know, at that time, the people of the Prophet were mostly idolaters and polytheists. So the Prophet came and he invited them to Tawheed, to monotheism, and he invited them to Allah and said, you have to believe in Allah or else you won't be delivered. You won't be saved. And the verse also says that the Prophet is an illuminating lamp. What does that mean? It means the Prophet is a person who guides people to the right path, to the straight path. He is like an illuminating lamp that shines and, you know, lights the whole place. If you're in a dark place and you have a lamp, you know where you're going. But if you don't have a lamp, you could, you know, you don't know where exactly you're going. You might fall into a pit, okay? So, Prophet Muhammad, Sirajan Munira, an illuminating lamp who would guide people. وَبَشِّرِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ بِأَنَّ لَهُم مِّنَ اللَّهِ فَضْلًا كَبِيرًا. This is not, this is actually something that Allah tells the Prophet to do. He says, and give good tidings to the believers that they will have from Allah great bounty. Again, the verse does not confine that grace and that reward, bounty, to the hereafter. It says that they will have it in this world as well, not just the hereafter. Because people, they tend to think that, you know, we have to be good because we will only be rewarded in the hereafter. And we have to stop being bad because we will only be punished in the hereafter. Now, the problem with this misconception is that if you only think that you will be rewarded after a long time, and in the hereafter, after you die, that will not motivate you to actually try to do good things. You know, it's like, oh, that's like, I have to wait until the end of my life to receive my rewards. That's going to take a long time. So it's not like that. Those who live a good life, they will be rewarded. And we have a verse in the Quran that says this. It says, من عمل صالحا من ذكر أو أنثى وهو مؤمن فلنحيينه حياة طيبة فلنحيينه حياة طيبة. It means if you are a good person, whether you're male or female, and you are a believer, Allah will give you a really good life. And the verse continues and says, وَلَنَجْزِيَنَّهُمْ أَجْرَهُمْ بِأَحْسَنِ مَا كَانُوا يَعْمَلُونَ. And we will surely give them their reward in the hereafter according to the best of what they used to do. So we have to be good people, and we should not be bad people, because we will face the consequences of our actions, not only in the other world, but in this world as well. And we have verses of the Quran that prove this. This is not something I'm making up. And we will talk about those verses in the next episodes. Thank you for listening to the show, Like Muhammad. I leave you in the care and protection of Allah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Be like Muhammad and live like Muhammad and give like Muhammad gave. Shafi'ullah, Habibullah, Nabiullah, Rasulullah, Khalilullah, the friend of Allah, Ya Rasulullah, Rasulullah.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the Hall of Shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. America gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice. Our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. The thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up?
Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too
Midstream. Tonight, we sit down with a Lebanese Member of Parliament for the Armenian Orthodox seat, part of the reformist bloc, Pola Yakubyan. As a descendant of Armenian survivors who escaped a historic genocide, Ms. Yakubyan brings a deeply personal perspective to today's crisis in Gaza, a collapse into what many now call genocide. Yet amid the grief unfolding there, she has taken a controversial stance, supporting the Lebanese government's move to disarm Hezbollah, a group many believe protects Lebanon from Zionist Israel's repeated violations. In this episode, we confront this paradox head-on. We explore how, in the face of escalating aggressions, not only in Lebanon, but across Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and even small Persian Gulf Arab states, she can advocate for dismantling Lebanon's only credible deterrent. Can she square this position with her ancestral legacy? And what does it say about Lebanon's future? Ms. Pola, thank you very much for your time and your contribution to our show on this day. I want to start with what's really important in the region at the moment. And I know that you yourself is a descendant of the Armenian genocide. So my condolences that extends through time for that genocide. And I know that you mention Gaza and say that it is a modern genocide. How do you see what's unfolding at the moment when the Zionist entity basically is telling the Palestinian people, leave all of Gaza City?
So thank you for having me. I'm going to speak in Arabic because I can see this is very, very tricky. I feel much more comfortable speaking in Arabic.
No problem.
And again, thank you for having me. I'm the daughter of a genocide survivor, not the granddaughter.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Yes, sure. And you said something as if there is a paradox or a contradiction between me defending the Armenian genocide and at the same time, you know, asking to disarm Hezbollah. These are not two opposing values at all.
We will talk extensively about that.
Okay.
But first,
you
first
give me the time to talk about
it. I want to begin with Gaza.
With Gaza.
At the moment,
yes.
Telling a 1.7 million population to leave the area. What do you think about that?
This is the craziest thing. It's so insane that no one could have imagined anything like that. But I mean, now we are in an era where everything is surreal, but the problem is that it's happening in reality. ما في كلام يوصف اللي عم بيصير بصراحة.
There are no words to truly capture the massacres unfolding before the eyes of the entire world, nor the Arab and international impotence in stopping a criminal like Benjamin Netanyahu. Without a doubt, humanity has descended into a very dark abyss.
And despite seeing that and going through the horrors that we went through over the past almost 700 days in Lebanon and seeing what Zionist Israel was capable of doing, not only in Lebanon, which supposedly people say it was Lebanon's fault for poking the bear. Mm. But Syria never poked the bear, especially after the fall of Bashar al-Assad. Doha never, ever poked the bear, and it was hit hard during this past week. And yet you want to see the arms of Hezbollah taken away. Why is that?
I demand that this armament of Hezbollah, not now, but from day one. It was clear to every Lebanese person that these weapons undermine the very project of state building in Lebanon. They erode any possibility of building institutions, a secure country, and a place where all citizens can live in safety. We were told that those arms protect us, that they are Lebanon's strength. The events of the recent war have shown otherwise. Those weapons do not deter, and in no way do they protect. The tragedy of the latest war continues to unfold today, and Lebanon has borne the cost alone on behalf of all Arabs. 50 years of conflict, and Lebanon has paid the price by itself. The continued presence of arms in Hezbollah's hands is, without doubt, an invitation for Zionist Israel to persist in its occupation, its raids, its destruction, the razing of land, and the devastation of Lebanese infrastructure and livelihoods. Those weapons have failed to protect Hezbollah's own leadership, have not protected Lebanon, have not safeguarded Hezbollah's environment, and they have not empowered Lebanese citizens to defend themselves. On the contrary, they have invited increasing destruction. Today, we must all admit that handing those weapons over is the true source of strength Lebanon can rely upon. Whenever we tell Zionist Israel to withdraw and stop attacking Lebanon, the response is Hezbollah has weapons and will not give them up. That excuse must be removed. Lebanon must rebuild its institutions and its state. It must have a strong national army. Strengthening the army begins with dissolving all militias, starting with Hezbollah, and transferring every weapon to our national army, which should include the sons of our nation from all sects and regions.
This is a debate that is widely open in Lebanon, but there's an issue here where you started by saying all Lebanese people agree that, and then you continued. But if that was the case, you started by saying كل لبنانيين, by saying that, you are...
I did not say that all Lebanese people agreed on disarming Hezbollah. No. There are those who are convinced the weapons should remain, or that they should be bargained with in exchange for some price.
So let's take that into consideration and think about the people who have lost everything and for the past 50 years have been losing and have been giving their own families, their own shops, their own businesses, their own lives. You all know the entire story of it. But why not go ahead and make a referendum? Let the people say what they want to say.
In Lebanon, we have unfortunately never restored to a census or anything of the sort. But we do have a clear constitution. The Lebanese constitution does not speak of the existence of militias or arms outside the control of the security forces and the national army. What previous governments did was to legitimize Hezbollah's weapons through their ministerial statements. That no longer exists today, and there is no longer any legal or legitimate cover whatsoever for those arms. Our constitution is crystal clear. It speaks of gathering all weapons from the hands of every militia. The exception granted to Hezbollah in the early 1990s has expired. The time has come to turn our focus toward building a state in Lebanon. It is clear that with the existence of a state within a state and Hezbollah's arsenal, a proper state cannot be built, nor can a strong army. The two simply cannot coexist. Can you name a single country in the world that has both a militia and a national army, at the same time enjoys success, stability, and security? There is no such example anywhere on the face
of the earth. I would argue that there was something similar to what happened in Lebanon after the liberation, for example, like France, but they took over the government, and this never happened in Lebanon.
In France, there was a resistance during the German occupation, if that's what you are referring to. But once the state was restored, once they regained their land, the it was no longer a militia
or
anything of the sort.
Because they took over and they literally killed everyone who was part of the Nazi government. But in Lebanon, that never happened because it was integrated into the community. And as
you're making an analogy that I don't think applies to Lebanon.
I'm giving you an example, and you say it wouldn't work in Lebanon. And maybe other people could say that what you think is a pretext for Israel to come and attack us is not the case, for example, of Syria, that for 55 years, not even a bullet was fired at Zionist Israel, and they took more than 700 kilometers squared of Syria. Doha is in an economic and political alliance with Zionist Israel, and they were bombed. One of their police, I think, if I'm not mistaken, one Qatari national was killed alongside with other four Palestinians as well. Added to that,
are you trying to say that if the weapons are no longer in Hezbollah's hands today, Zionist Israel will be deterred from striking Lebanon?
And I'm asking you, if there was a disarmament without arming the government, what do you think will happen?
Those weapons would be handed over to the Lebanese army and become a strength for all Lebanese, because they would be given to the national institution that unites Lebanese from all sects.
But Zionist Israel has been bombing the Lebanese army as well.
Instead of being a partisan weapon in the hands of a segment of Lebanese society, it will be a weapon under the national army's control, endorsed by a broad national consensus. That is one point. The second point is that Zionist Israel attacks Lebanon daily, claiming it is pursuing Hezbollah's weapons and anyone who cooperates with Hezbollah.
So it's okay for civilians to die?
There are assassinations and daily attacks on these depots. If those depots were handed over instead of exploding, if they were transferred to the army, wouldn't that be an added point of strength for Lebanon, rather than giving Zionist Israel a pretext to blow them up?
Didn't Syria do exactly that? Didn't Syria, the Syrian regime that is now a very good friend with Israel, they're still bombing up until now the Syrian Arab Army's warehouses?
When Ahmad Sharaa regime took power in Syria, Zionist Israel destroyed Bashar al-Assad's entire arsenal.
They're still doing it now, yesterday, in Homs, in Hama.
No, listen to me. Listen and focus. The Israeli entity army dismantled every major part of the Syrian military stockpile. It didn't destroy it while Bashar was still consolidating power, as if the Israelis had been comfortable with his being Iran's ally. They did not dismantle his arsenal the way they did when the regime came to power. I consider that the weapons are now in the hands of the regime and therefore could pose a threat to Zionist Israel. The Israeli entity neutralized everything the Syrian army possessed when the new regime arrived. Before that, Zionist Israel used to carry out strikes on Syria, but it didn't systematically destroy its naval and ground fleets and other capabilities like it did once the regime assumed control. Today, Zionist Israel says it wants to protect the Druze and Suwaida and is trying to create a David corridor. I am not debating Israeli entity ambitions with you. I am discussing what Lebanon's interest is today. Lebanon's interest right now is that any faction possessing weapons outside Lebanese legitimacy should hand those weapons over to the legitimate authority, specifically to President Joseph Hon, who was the army commander and is trusted by Lebanese. Nawaf Salam has a record of resistance and support for the Palestinian cause.
He was part of the 17 of April.
You can laugh as much as you like.
17 of May. He was part of the 17 of May treacherous agreement with
Nawaf Salam.
Nawaf Salam has nothing, neither near nor far, to do with the May 17th agreement. That is a rumor. That is a false rumor.
There are people who are with him who have gave witness ideas.
Give me any evidence for that. There is no evidence. It's just talk. Nawaf Salam's entire career and his work at the United Nations and the International Court of Justice are on the record. And there is a broad campaign against him in the United States, precisely because he supports the Palestinian cause. The minister who is allied with him, Omar Ibsat, has been the target of a long campaign because his wife at Columbia University supported Palestine. Nawaf's whole team comes under random fire from these people because they back the Palestinian cause. But when it comes to the Lebanese question, he acts in the interest of his country and its people. Today we must think about how to unite Lebanese and rebuild the state, because we have paid every price. Iran turned Lebanon into a front to defend its regime, not to defend Lebanese interests.
This is not true. I'm sorry, I have to say this is not true. Can you ask me why?
That is your opinion. As for mine, when Iran strikes, it fires missiles and hits Zionist Israel hard. But when Hassan Nasrallah is killed and Lebanese are killed, Iran watches and does nothing. We saw that in the last war. What did Iran do?
They reciprocated after the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. But the Lebanese case, they retaliated in April, and they retaliated again after the assassination of both Haniyeh and Nasrallah.
They struck inside Iran and assassinated a figure who was a guest in Iran. I am talking about the neutralization of Hezbollah's leadership. What was Iran's response? The Iranian response was nothing, not even a gesture to save face.
I think that the Lebanese people have enough men to defend their land. This is what they've been doing since 1982.
Iran fights only to preserve its regime. Sadly, using the last Arab Shia as a shield, not for those people themselves. I understand states act
us being
from interest
here,
and influence.
Platform on, for people who are openly against the resistance.
It seems this will be the first and last time you come to see.
No, definitely not. Because whatever happens, at the end of the day, we're both Lebanese, and we believe that Lebanon deserves to be a peaceful place to live in for everyone. But you said something very important. You gave way for a solution to the problem, which is Hezbollah needs to give out the weapons so Israel wouldn't have a pretext to bomb.
I want my country, a livable country.
What guarantees
sacrifices?
With Zionist Israel being a neighbor, that's near impossible. But what guarantee is, let's say that disarmament happened. Okay? It was given to the Lebanese army. What guarantees can you provide as a member of parliament that Zionist Israel will not do the exact same thing it did in Syria to the Lebanese army?
Please allow me. You did not explain to me how Hezbollah is actually deterring Zionist Israel from attacking. Explain or show us. How does Hezbollah today prevent Zionist Israel from striking?
There's a ceasefire.
Lebanon.
They're abiding by a ceasefire.
Zionist Israel complies. Then they go do something. Are they doing anything? Not at all. Only words. An attack on anyone who tells them, look, this weapon no longer serves any purpose. It harms rather than helps. Think how to protect people after an environment that has already given so many martyrs and sacrifices. Save the people. I'll tell you, in the war, those who paid the heaviest price were Hezbollah's own community, more than anyone else. All of Lebanon suffered. But the most affected are the people from that party's environment. And to this day, we risk dragging them into another slaughter, while the whole world seeks its own interests and self-protection. So, you can ask me why Syria didn't respond, why Qatar didn't act, why such and such happened. I care about my country that is destroyed again and again. Even in 1982, in solidarity with the Palestinians, Iran decided to arm a group of Shia in Lebanon and turn them into a front line to defend its regime.
They liberated South Lebanon.
From 1982 until today, they have used these people. In that context, there is no doubt that the South, which was originally occupied, as a result of wider conflicts extending beyond Lebanon, was liberated. But from all these years until today, Lebanon has slid into a frightening abyss economically, financially, and socially. Every 10 or 15 years, we suffer a devastating war. And the last war was the hardest. We hoped it would be the last. For it to be the last, Hezbollah's weapons must be removed and Lebanon completely neutralized. Tell me why Zionist Israel is not present in Jordan or Egypt or elsewhere and only wants to strike Lebanon. Lebanon gives it pretext. It provides the rationale of a supporting battle. You might tell me Zionist Israel would do it anyway. My duty is not to give a pretext when I cannot protect people. My duty, when I know I am making the weakest technological and military contributions, is to watch over the world. The primary political goal is the welfare of the people and their lives, not endlessly reciting slogans of pride and dignity while, in the end, they have no roof over their heads. Allow me. For me, this policy is destructive and deadly. My country has paid dearly for it.
So it was a decision by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah to die. He decided that he needs to die and kill everyone with him.
Unfortunately, he miscalculated. Lebanon paid the price. And of course, his constituency did too.
Wouldn't you want someone to have helped your father during his own genocide, the way that Hezbollah tried to help the Palestinians when no one else cared about them?
خليني أقول لك بيي كيف تساعد. تم قتل الأرمن.
Allow me to tell you how my father was helped. Armenians were killed and displaced, and some Arabs and Arab tribes helped some of the Armenians. At that time, some states stood with the Armenians and others stood with their own interests. Christian Germany stood with Turkey. Arabs stood by the Armenians. It was a struggle unlike the current conflict in every possible way. The two are not comparable. They are not comparable.
But there was death, destruction, genocide, kids being burned alive. That's exactly what happened in Gaza.
True. So why doesn't Iran fight today for these people? If, as you claim, Iran should continue the war, it should not have stopped. It should not have let the IAEA re-enter. It should not have bowed to American demands. It should have sacrificed itself, continued supplying Gaza, and kept its missiles flying. It should have kept striking Israel regardless of the cost. That is what you are telling me, ma'am.
Would you have supported that if that happened?
You asked me. You compared what happened to my father and his people. It was not the same. They did not have the capacity to fight, so they were killed. Some Arabs stood with them, but those Arabs did not have the ability to wage war on Turkey. They did not want to start a war with the Ottoman authorities for the Armenians. What does that mean? How can you compare that to a situation today in which Iran can continue striking Zionist Israel, yet it chose not to?
And all the Arabs that are also being bombed by Israel, they can do the same.
You want me to keep the Lebanese front open, continue supporting Gaza, even through Iran, even though Iran, which is stronger than us, does not want to?
But there, we reached a ceasefire that did not take place in Lebanon. It was in November 27. It did not go into effect in Lebanon until 3 months later, where the Lebanese army should have taken control, and it didn't.
Zionist Israel today does not respect the ceasefire. We keep reminding Zionist Israel that it must stop its attacks. Answer me. Why doesn't Hezbollah respond to Zionist Israel? Because those weapons no longer deter or defend. Any military scholar today knows there is an unfortunate technological superiority and use of artificial intelligence that we Lebanese do not possess. If we decide to drag Lebanon into a new war, we are dragging Lebanese people into an unequal fight. People tell them, Allah is with you and will grant you victory. But this is not translated into reality on the ground. Will the killing continue?
Is this some sort of criticism against the ideology? Because I heard there was a trend, a criticism against the ideology, because there was a trend 2 weeks ago, because you said that Hezbollah's ideology is more dangerous than the armament itself inside of Hezbollah.
Thank you for pointing out that I said the Hezbollah ideology. I said the ideology of the weapons, the ideology behind the weapons. I did not speak about the Shia in any way.
I didn't say that because there's a video.
You didn't say that, and you were right. But others are running a campaign claiming that I was.
Doesn't matter because you know what you said.
I need to clarify because the campaign even reached Iran. Allow me to explain. The essence of the campaign was false, and they inserted the word Shia, which I never used. I spoke clearly about a specific ideology that Hezbollah follows.
This is my question. Is this a criticism of the ideology that more than 1.5 million people now embrace, which gives you there's a responsibility for you as an official person to maybe put a perspective in front of these people? How would you convince them with your topic?
If you let me continue, we can reach the point I want to make. I spoke about a political party just as I speak about the Muslim Brotherhood when I address them. I'm not speaking about all Sunnis. When I talk about the misdeeds of right-wing Christian parties, I'm not talking about all Christians. Shia ideology is one thing. Hezbollah is another. The Muslim Brotherhood is one thing, Sunnis are another. Parties that call themselves Christian are one thing, Christianity itself is another. This is a political distinction, and any other interpretation is wrong.
Convince me. I am a Lebanese from South Lebanon. Convince me that your point is valid when all of my beloved throughout the past years have been either buried, murdered, maimed, or detained by Zionist Israel, and the Lebanese government was nowhere to be found.
You have to convince me how the weapons protected you when many members of your family were killed, their homes destroyed, and all that. You have to convince me how the weapons protected you.
I'm the people. You're the government.
No, I am not the government at all. People elect me, meaning I run against everyone. So I am not in the government.
Yeah, but you support that decision by the government. So as a civilian, as a citizen, it's not my choice or my perspective to convince you. You should convince me. Do you think that Nawaf Salam is doing all his best to convince these people in specific?
Look, today Hezbollah's constituency needs to convince Nawaf Salam to continue protecting them through rationalizing Hezbollah by handing over the weapons and transforming Hezbollah into a political party like other parties, not an armed party bringing calamity to its own people.
When has he ever protected them? They're still dying. Where did he protect them?
Fine. Very good. Nawaf Salam claims that with these weapons, the killing will continue. You fall into a blatant contradiction because you are telling me to convince you how these weapons do not protect you.
Did you visit those people? Did you visit and talk to the people?
This has nothing to do with my question.
Did you visit to talk to those people, to tell them they should listen to Nawaf Salam?
I visited them multiple times and spoke to a large number of them.
After this war?
Many came to us, and we helped them without asking questions about backgrounds or affiliations or anything else.
Did you ask them about the
weapons? During the war, we also helped people. Who drags people into the slaughter, the political decision? I spoke with them during the war and after the war. I also always met Hezbollah members of parliament and asked them, where are you taking Hezbollah's constituency and the people? And how long will this continue?
What do they say?
No answer. Some talk about guarantees. What guarantees are there that keeping the weapons will lead to any different outcome? But I have a question for you. Allow me. If Iran today negotiated with the U.S. and decided to relinquish its Lebanese card and asked Hezbollah to hand over the weapons, would Hezbollah comply? What guarantees would there be? Or does Hezbollah simply hand over the weapons when Iran tells them to?
I think the people have decided in South Lebanon that even if Hezbollah decides to disarm, they have every right to defend their own land, similar to what they were doing from 1936 to 1982. We will never leave our land to Zionist Israel.
Who is asking you to leave your land?
Did you ask me what happened to me or my family during the war and after it? I couldn't reach my house, and no one helped. The Lebanese government never helped. They put a condition that they will only do reconstruction unless we disarm the very people that protect us.
And the reason your house was allowed to be destroyed is the war of support and the presence of weapons. Zionist Israel considers those weapons.
This is what the Lebanese government is. This is what the Lebanese government is saying. I want to tell you that I'm enjoying this because we need this. We need this debate to happen. And sadly, we don't have more time to continue. But can you promise me that we can continue this later, especially after most probably what will happen to the Palestinian in Gaza in the upcoming weeks will be devastating.
I would love to continue this debate, and I would love to talk to you. But I want to tell you something.
All I am saying comes from a place of love, from a heart that cares for all of Lebanon. Because I do not discriminate between one Lebanese and another. My son belongs to the noble Shiite sect. My son's name is Paul Mahdi. And I am proud of that. And when his dad decided he wanted to name him Paul, not I wanted to also give him an Arabic middle name. Because I do not recognize the borders drawn by Hezbollah or by parties that act as Hezbollah's replicas, claiming to oppose Hezbollah. I do not recognize any red lines between Lebanese citizens. What saddens me and grieves me is that once again, we are taking people based on sect and religion to their destruction and ruin. not for the interest of their country, but for Iran's interest. I understand that Iran has its own agendas and that it looks after the interests of its regime. My job is the interest of all Lebanese, whether Shia, Sunni, Armenian, whoever they are. I thank you again for bearing with me.
It's my duty to do so. Thank you very much for this.
You also have to promise me that you will not cut any of my answers.
We never do that, and I promise you, on my show, we don't do that. I want to thank you very much for your contribution, ladies and gents. I want to thank you. Please do follow us, and we'll keep updating you from the region of West Asia right here on the Middle East stream. Assalamu alaikum.
IRIB English Radio. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are a true guide.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all around the world. This is a new episode of The Last Savior. I'm Asma once more. I have the honor to be at your service as the host. Well, and as always, we have Dr. Alavi in here with us, and he's going to help us with his insight on the study of The Last Savior and the time of his reappearance. This was just the introduction to our discussion for today. As you already know, Dr. Alavi has got his major studies and researches on the reappearance of Imam Mahdi Ajalallah Farajah, and then we're going to be using his insights in today's episode, as always. So, assalamu alaikum, Doctor, and welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Thank you very much for cooperating. Well, it's been some episodes that we're talking about the differences between the two ages, before the advent of Imam Mahdi Ajalallah Farajah and after that time, the age that is about to come. And we have mentioned plenty of these differences. Well, about the time before that, I guess we already by now can relate to many of these factors that Dr. Alavi listed for us based on the narrations of Imam Sadr alayhi salam. And then for after that, it was just the reverse and a sort of compensation for what exists before the advent of Imam Mahdi Ajalallah Farajah. So still, there are some perhaps details that we need to talk about. And Doctor is going to help us with that.
Well, in our previous sessions, we have been talking about the world before the advent of Imam Mahdi al-Islam and the characteristics of that world and the world after the advent of Imam. And in our last show, we have been talking about the developments that the whole society, the whole universe will see with regard to the blessing existence of Imam Mahdi al-Islam. The universal blessings, either from sky and earth, that becoming quite open to human beings and to the inhabitants of the world, and the blessings that are being showered on the inhabitants of the world. We have been talking about all these changes that will happen and the progress that humanity will see with regard to the knowledge and science. So the earth is not going to be stingy and mean anymore. We said that تظهر له الكنوز ولا يبقى في الأرض خراب إلا يعمره. That is, all the resources of the earth will be becoming generous to human beings.
Treasures of earth are going to be exposed.
And resources of the earth will become all generous to the inhabitants of the earth. So we see a sort of very drastic differences between the world before and the world after the advent of Imam, that they cannot even be compared. I mean, if we want to compare, it's as if you are asked to compare what is in common between this good and this bad. So we cannot find any comparison, I mean, here, in anything in common to compare that. We say whatever was bad there has been changed to goodness here in this new world order. So this new world order that we are talking about is something that is going to be available by the blessed existence of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So his existence of a person that much important that brings the whole world in order here? Definitely yes. We have seen in the life of the Holy Prophet, wherever he actually stepped in, that place was becoming blessed. And people after him, I mean, and the people right after him, after the steps of the Holy Prophet, found plenty of blessings that they could understand that this person, the existence of which is full of blessing. I mean, wherever he enters. So the same way that the Prophet was full of blessing, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is full of blessing. So it is like, it's to some extent like the Day of Judgment, that people are always feeling pity for not having him all these years, all these ages. Why do we call Qiyam Yawm al-Hasra? That is, we feel pity for whatever good that we could do, but we didn't. Mm-hmm. We could do, but we haven't. The same way that people will be feeling like, I mean, we could have Mahdi earlier, but we ourselves deprive ourselves from his existence. And he and his government is the peak of divine blessing that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala actually pours and showers on his servants and his creatures. And it is due to the efforts of divine prophets in the whole history. So Mahdi is the gist of Allah's divine messengers. That is, he's going to be the utmost and ultimate level of goodness on the scene of the earth. So this is the world after the advent of Mahdi alayhi salam.
So speaking of this world, which right now for us seems like a dream, but then as you just explained, through all the changes that are going to happen, we're going to be part of if God willing, that would happen very soon, then we all are going to be a part of this revolutionary utopian world. So right now we go for a break and then we come back to continue our discussion. Welcome back. This is The Last Savior. I'm Asma, and Dr. Alavi in here, like always, he's helping us with his insights about the discussion of the reappearance, the time of reappearance of Imam Mahdi Ajalallah Farajah. And, you know, there are always many questions, personal questions about Imam Mahdi himself. Like, where is he going to leave? Is he practicing the same life that we practice? Is his life going to be natural just like us? And most specifically, if we want to get into details, we would love to know more about where is he going to be living? Like which country perhaps, which city and how?
Well, as for the place of life of Imam Hadi alayhi salam, Imam Bakr alayhi salam says that after his revolution, he will move towards Kufa. Kufa, a city in Iraq. We call it the beginning of this revolution, mm-hmm. from Mecca to Medina. And from Medina, he comes towards Iraq, I mean, to the city of Kufa. He will reside there. He will stay there, and he will choose that as the place of his life.
Yeah.
So I want to say, how is it like that we have been told about all the details of the Imam Ali Salam, though, I mean, this place that where Imam Ali Salam is going to live might not be that much important for us. I mean, it's not, I mean, very crucial issue for us to know or not to know. I mean, it doesn't change anything for us.
Exactly.
And it doesn't going to reduce anything from our duties as awaiters of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. But as for sense of curiosity that actually forces us to ask, so we want to say that, okay, all these details have been answered by the infallible imams.
Exactly.
So it means it's a well organized structure for the arrival and advent of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So it was a very beautiful plan that was engineered by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and it was given to the Holy Prophet, and the whole message was given to all the infallible imams, and all of them are aware of this important event that is going to happen, that is the advent of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So he'll be living in the city of Kufa, and he will select that city as the place of his residence. Imam Ali alayhi salam,
for the rest of his life?
Sorry?
For the rest of his life?
For the rest of his life. Yeah, he will reside for the rest of his life in the city of Kufa. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, but it doesn't mean that Imam is not going to move anywhere.
Exactly,
but
yeah.
He will go to
surely.
Anywhere. But Imam Ali alayhi salam says in a hadith that it's as if I see our people, that is Muslims or Shias, at the masjid of Kufa, that they have set up tents and they're reciting Quran in the way that it was revealed. But what does it mean? So Quran was revealed to the Holy Prophet once, and the Quran that we have at hand is the same Quran that was revealed to the Holy Prophet. So what does Imam Ali Islam say here? Revealed, I mean, in the interpretation, because the real interpreter of Quran is there. Imam Ali Islam continues and says that when Mahdi will arise, he will open that the gates of that masjid, in the masjid of Kufa, for people, and he will make its Qibla very firm. That is, what does it mean? I mean, by Qibla, it means the establishment of prayers in front of Kaaba. So this establishment of prayers in front of Kaaba, reciting Salat in front of Kaaba, will be more firm than before. And Imam Ali Salam, in another hadith, says to Malik ibn Hamza that in this time, when Mahdi arises, he will collect all the people over one common belief. So it means the beliefs of people are corrected already. I mean, he has already told them what the genuine and pure belief Muhammadan Islam is. So that's why he collects all the people with the common belief towards himself. He'll establish government based on justice and based on laws and regulations. Again, Imam Ali alayhi salam in another hadith says that Imam Mahdi will punish the wretched judges, those judges who actually decided wrongly in the courts.
Yeah.
And again, he will dismiss the rulers who are wrongdoers, I mean the oppressors, from ruling over the people. So whoever is oppressing people has no more right to actually rule over the people. And he will differentiate between any good and bad. And he will make the world, and he will make the world clean of any badness. I mean, by badness here, I think apparently it means bad actions of bad people. So it means that whoever has any grudges from a person at the time before the advent of Imam Ali Islam, from some people, he will see that, okay, these changes are going for the goodness and for the betterment of the affairs of the people. He will understand the changes for the goodness of the affairs of the society. And he feels it. He likes it. I mean, people will praise Mahdi for whatever he's doing, because this is something that it's in their heart.
Yeah.
They see that, okay, this person was an oppressor. Imam actually brings him down and dismiss him from that. position that he was in. We know that the other person actually oppressed lots of people. So we see that Imam comes and actually
takes action,
gives them this, gives them their right due. We have some other hadith. When Mahdi appears and when Mahdi arises, all the grudges will get out of the hearts. So people, in case they are in touch with each other, they are always leaning towards each other. They are very kind towards each other. There is no hiqd and kina.
Animosity.
There is no animosity and grudges between people and in their relations with others, either inside the family bonds or outside the family structure, which is the society.
Not wishing to bring them down in order for you to get the job or in order for you to get the money or all of the things that we see right now in today's world.
Yeah, because they have already seen that, okay, whoever did bad on them, they have received their due. I mean, so what is the reason, or what could be the reason to, I mean, to not to be lenient and not to be kind to others? Because whoever actually wronged them, they have reached their due and they have been punished for whatever
they
did. They
would embrace whatever they deserve.
Definitely.
So that would seem so much like a dream I said at the very beginning of today's episode. But then always talking about this dream gives us this driving force to move forward, to prepare and pave the road for these changes to happen. And it doesn't mean that we have to keep all the bad things that we have right now for that day to change. No. We have to prepare ourselves for that change to happen. So this was all for today's episode. I hope you have just enjoyed it. Until another episode of The Last Savior, wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest glow?
To all of mankind, this was his call.